And sensible enough for an Englishman. See, wasn't it quite his fault, Ken? We were looking at a snake, and it came up the branch toward us, and... Well, it was an accident, he concluded, handing Rollo another piece of fish. You've not seen the lad yourself, though.
No.
And I think you are deliberately changing the subject.
Aye, I am. Do you want a bit more beer?
She raised an eyebrow at him. He needn't think he was going to escape that easily, but nodded, accepting the jug. They were quiet for a bit, drinking beer and watching the last of the light fade into darkness as the stars came out. The scent of the pine trees strengthened, their sap warmed from the day, and in the distance she heard the occasional gunshot warning slap of a beaver's tail on the pond. Evidently the beavers had posted sentries, in case she or Rollo should sneak back after dark, she thought wryly. Ian had wrapped his own blanket round his shoulders against the growing chill, and was lying flat in the grass, staring upward into the vault of heaven overhead. She didn't make any pretense of not watching him, and was quite sure he was aware of it. His face was quiet for the moment, minus its usual animation, but not guarded. He was thinking, and she was content to let him take his time. It was autumn now, and night would be long enough for many things. She wished she had thought to ask her mother more about the girl Ian called Emily. The Mohawk name was something multisyllabic and unpronounceable. Small, her mother had said, pretty in a neat, small-bone sort of way, and very clever.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
A Breath of Snow and Ashes by Diana Gabaldon.
Was she dead, Emily, the small and clever? She thought not. She'd been in this time long enough to have seen many men deal with the death of wives. They showed loss and grief, but they didn't do what Ian had been doing. Could he be taking her to meet Emily? That was a staggering thought, but one she rejected almost immediately. It would be a month's journey at least to reach the Mohawks' territory, probably more. But then...
I wondered, Ken, he said suddenly, still looking up at the sky. Do you feel sometimes wrong?
He glanced at her helplessly, not sure whether he'd said what he meant. But she understood him perfectly. Yes, all the time. She felt a sense of instant, unexpected relief at the admission. He saw the slump of her shoulders and smiled a little crookedly. Well, maybe not all the time, she amended. When I'm out in the woods alone, it's fine. Or with Roger, by ourselves. Though, even then... She saw Ian's eyebrow lift and hurried to explain. Not that. Not being with him. It's just that we talk about what was. He gave her a look in which sympathy was mingled with interest. Plainly, he would like to know about what was, but put that aside for the moment.
The woods, he said. I see that. When I'm awake, at least. Sleeping, though.
He turned his back toward the empty sky and the brightening stars. Are you afraid, when the dark comes on? She'd felt that now and then, a moment of deep fear at twilight, a sense of abandonment and elemental loneliness as night rose from the earth. A feeling that sometimes remained even when she had gone inside the cabin, the bolted door secure behind her.
No, he said, frowning a little at her. You are?
Just a little, she said, waving it away. Not all the time, not now. But what is it about sleeping in the woods? He sat up and rocked back a little, big hands linked around one knee, thinking.
Well, he said slowly, Sometimes I think of the old tales from Scotland, and ones I've heard now and then, living with the Gaiangahaga, about things that may come upon a man while he sleeps, to lure away his soul. Things? Despite the beauty of the stars and the peace of the evening, she felt something small and cold slide down her back. What things? He took a deep breath and blew it out, brows puckered. You call them she in the Gaelic. The Cherokee call them the Nanahi. And the Mohawk have names for them too, more than one. But when I heard Eats Turtles tell of them, I kent at once what they were. It's the same. The old folk. Fairies, she said. And her incredulity must have been clear in her voice, for he glanced up sharply at her, a glint of irritation in his eyes. No, I ken what you mean by that. Roger Mack showed me the wee picture you drew for Jem. All tiny things like dragonflies prinking in the flowers. He made an uncouth noise in the back of his throat. Nay, these things are... He made a helpless gesture with one big hand, frowning at the grass. Vitamins, he said suddenly, looking up. Vitamins, she said, and rubbed a hand between her brows. It had been a long day. They had likely walked 15 or 20 miles, and fatigue had settled like water in her legs and back. The bruises from her battle with the beavers were beginning to throb. I see. Ian, are you sure that your head isn't still a bit cracked? She said it lightly, but her real anxiety, lest it be true, must have shown in her voice, for he gave a low, rueful chuckle. No, or at least, I dinna think so. I was only... Well, do you see, it's like that. You canna see the vitamins, but you and Auntie Claire can wail that they're there. And Uncle Jamie and I must take it on faith that you're right about it. I ken as much about the old ones. Can you no believe me about that? Well, I... She had begun to agree for the sake of peace between them. But a feeling swept over her, sudden and cold as a cloud shadow, that she wished to say nothing to acknowledge the notion. Not out loud. And not here. Oh, he said, catching sight of her face. So you do know? I don't know, no, she said. But I don't know it's not either. And I don't think it's a good idea to talk about things like that in a wood at night, 1,000,000 miles away from civilization. All right? He smiled a little at that and nodded in acceptance. Aye. And it's no what I meant to say, really. It's more... His feathery brows knitted in concentration. When I was a bairn, I'd wake in my bed, and I'd ken at once where I was, There was the window, he flung out a hand, and there was the basin and ewer on the table, with a blue band round the top. And there, he pointed toward a laurel bush, was the big bed where Janet and Michael were sleeping. And Jockey the dog at the bedfit, farting like a beetle, and the smell of peat smoke from the fire, and, well, even if I should wake at midnight and the house all still around me, I should ken at once where I was. She nodded, the memory of her own old room in the house on Fury Street rising around her, vivid as a vision in the smoke, the striped wool blanket itchy under her chin, and the mattress with the indentation of her body in the middle, cupping her like a huge warm hand. Angus, the stuffed Scotty with the ragged tam-o'-shanter who shared her bed, and the comforting hum of her parents' conversation from the living room below, punctuated by the baritone sax of the theme music from Perry Mason. Most of all, the sense of absolute security. She had to close her eyes and swallow twice before answering. Yes. I know what you mean.
Aye. Well, for some time after I left home, I might find myself sleeping rough with Uncle Jamie in the heather, or here and there in inns and pothouses.
I'd wake, with no notion where I was. And still, I'd ken I was in Scotland. It was all right.
He paused, lower lip caught between his teeth as he struggled to find the right words.
Then things happened. I wasn't in Scotland any longer, and home was gone.
His voice was soft, but she could hear the echo of loss in it.
I would wake with no idea where I might be, or who.
He was hunched over now, big hands hanging loose between his thighs as he gazed into the fire.
But when I lay with Emily, from the first time, I knew, Kent, who I was again.
He looked up at her then, eyes dark and shadowed by loss. My soul didn't wander while I slept,
when I slept with her.
And now it does, she asked quietly after a moment. He nodded wordless. The wind whispered in the trees above. She tried to ignore it, obscurely afraid that if she listened closely, she might hear words. Ian, she said, and touched his arm very lightly. Is Emily dead? He sat quite still for a minute, then took a deep, shuddering breath and shook his head.
I dinna think so.
He sounded very doubtful, though, and she could see the trouble in his face.
Ian, she said, very softly.
Come here. He didn't move, but when she scooted close and put her arms around him, he didn't resist. She pulled him down with her, insisting that he lie beside her, his head pillowed in the curve between shoulder and breast, her arm around him.
Mother instinct, she thought, wryly amused. Whatever's wrong, the first thing you do is pick them up and cuddle them. And if they're too big to lift, and if his warm weight and the sound of his breathing in her ear kept the voices in the wind at bay, so much the better.
She had a fragmentary memory, a brief vivid image of her mother standing behind her father in the kitchen of their house in Boston. He lay back in a straight chair, his head against her mother's stomach, eyes closed in pain or exhaustion as she rubbed his temples. What had it been? A headache? But her mother's face had been gentle, the lines of her own day's stress smoothed away by what she was doing.
I feel a fool, Ian said, sounding shy, but didn't pull away. No, you don't.
He took a deep breath, squirmed a little, and settled cautiously into the grass, his body barely touching hers.
I will. I suppose not, then, he murmured.
He relaxed by wary degrees, his head growing heavier on her shoulder, the muscles of his back yielding slowly, their tension subsiding under her hand. Very tentatively, as though expecting her to slap him away, he lifted one arm and laid it over her. It seemed the wind had died. The firelight shone on his face, the dark dotted lines of his tattoos standing out against the young skin. His hair smelled of wood smoke and dust, soft against her cheek. "Tell me," she said. He sighed deeply.
"Not yet," he said. "When we get there, I..."
He would not say more, and they lay together, quiet in the grass, and safe. Brianna felt sleep come, the waves of it gentle, lifting her toward peace, and didn't resist. The last thing she recalled was Ian's face, cheek heavy on her shoulder, his eyes still open, watching the fire. Walking Elk was telling a story. It was one of his best stories, but Ian wasn't paying proper attention. He sat across the fire from Walking Elk, but it was the flames he was watching, not his friend's face.
Very odd, he thought.
He'd been watching fires all his life and never seen the woman in them until these winter months. Of course, peat fires had no great flame to speak of, though they had a good heat and a lovely smell.
Oh, aye. So she was there after all, the woman.
He nodded slightly, smiling. Walking Elk took this as an expression of approval at his performance and became even more dramatic in his gestures, scowling horrendously and lurching to and fro with bared teeth, growling in illustration of the glutton he had carefully tracked to its lair. The noise distracted Ian from the fire, drawing his attention to the story again. Just in time, for Walking Elk had reached the climax, and the young men nudged each other in anticipation. Walking Elk was short and heavily built, not so much unlike a glutton himself, which made his imitations that much more entertaining. He turned his head, wrinkling up his nose and growling through his teeth as the glutton caught the hunter's scent. Then he changed in a flash, became the hunter, creeping carefully through the brush, pausing, squatting low, and springing upward with a sharp yelp as his buttock encountered a thorny plant. The men around the fire whooped as Walking Elk became the glutton, who looked at first astonished at the noise, and then thrilled to have seen its prey. It leapt from its lair, uttering growls and sharp yips of rage. The hunter fell back, horrified, and turned to run. Walking Elk's stubby legs churned the pounded earth of the longhouse, running in place. Then he threw up his arms and sprawled forward with a despairing, "Aye!" as the glutton struck him in the back. The men shouted encouragement, slapping their palms on their thighs as the beleaguered hunter managed to roll onto his back, thrashing and cursing, grappling with the glutton that sought to tear out his throat. The firelight gleamed on the scars that decorated Walking Elk's chest and shoulders, thick white gouges that showed briefly at the gaping neck of his shirt as he writhed picturesquely, arms straining upward against his invisible enemy. Ian found himself leaning forward, his breath short, and his own shoulders knotted with effort, though he knew what was coming next. Walking Elk had done it many times, but it never failed. Ian had tried it himself, but couldn't do it at all. The hunter dug his heels and shoulders into the dirt, his body arched like a bow at full stretch. His legs trembled, his arms shook. Surely they would give way at any moment. The men by the fire held their breath. Then it came, a soft, sudden click. Distinct and somehow muffled, it was exactly the sound made by the breaking of a neck, the snap of bone and ligament muffled in flesh and fur. The hunter stayed arched a moment, unbelieving, and then slowly, slowly, lowered himself to the ground and sat up, staring at the body of his enemy, clutched limp in his hands. He cast up his eyes in prayerful thanks, then stopped, wrinkling his nose. He glanced down, face screwed into a grimace, and rubbed fastidiously at his leggings, soiled by the odorous voidings of the glutton. The hearth rocked with laughter. A small bucket of spruce beer was making the rounds. Walking Elk beamed, his face shiny with sweat, and accepted it. His short, thick throat worked industriously, sucking the sharp drink down as though it was water. He lowered the bucket at last, and looked about in dreamy satisfaction.
"You, Wolf's brother, tell us a story."
He threw the half-empty bucket across the fire. Ian caught it, only sloshing a little over his wrist. He sucked the liquid from his sleeve, laughed, and shook his head. He took a quick mouthful of beer and passed the bucket to Sleeps with Snakes beside him. Eats Turtles, on his other side, poked Ian in the ribs, wanting him to talk, but he shook his head again and shrugged, jerking his chin towards Snake. Snake, nothing loath, set the bucket neatly before him and leaned forward, the firelight dancing on his face as he began to talk. He was no actor like Walking Elk, but he was an older man, perhaps 30, and had travelled much in his youth. He had lived with the Assiniboine and the Cayuga, and had many stories from them which he told with great skill, if less sweat.
"Will you talk later, then?" Turtle said in Ian's ear. "I want to hear more tales of the great sea and the woman with green eyes."
Ian nodded, a little reluctant. He'd been very drunk the first time, or he would never have spoken of Gilis Abernathy. It was only that they had been drinking trader's rum, and the spinning sensation it caused in his head was very like that caused by the stuff she'd given him to drink, though the taste was different. That caused a giddiness that made his eyes blur, so candle flames streaked and ran like water, and the flames of the fire seemed to overflow and leap the hearthstones, glimmering all round her lavish room, small, separate blazes springing up in all the rounded surfaces of silver and glass, gems and polished wood, flickering brightest behind green eyes. He glanced around. There were no shining surfaces here. Clay pots, rough firewood, and the smooth poles of bed frames, grinding stones and woven baskets. Even the cloth and furs of their clothes were soft, dull colours that drowned the light. It must have been only the memory of those times of light-glazed dizziness that had brought her to mind. He seldom thought of the mistress. That was how the slaves and the other boys spoke of her. She needed no more name than that, for no one could imagine another of her sort. He didn't value his memories of her, but Uncle Jamie had told him not to hide from them, and he obeyed, finding it good counsel. He stared intently into the fire, only half-hearing Snake's recounting of the story about Goose, and how he had outwitted the evil one to bring tobacco to the people and save old man's life. Was it her, then, the witch Gilis, that he saw in the fire? He thought it was not. The woman in the fire gave him a warm feeling when he saw her, that ran from his heated face down through his chest, and curled up low and hot in his belly. The woman in the fire had no face. He saw her limbs, her curving back, a sweep of long, smooth hair twisting toward him, gone in a flicker. He heard her laugh, soft and breathy, far away. And it was not Gilis Abernathy's laugh. Still, Turtle's words had brought her to his mind, and he could see her there. He sighed to himself and thought what story he might tell when it came his turn. Perhaps he would tell about Mrs. Abernathy's twin slaves, the huge black men who did her every bidding. He had once seen them kill a crocodile and carry it up from the river between them to lay at her feet. He didn't mind so much. He had found, after that first drunken telling, that to speak of her in such a way caused him to think of her in the same way, as though she was a story, interesting but unreal. Perhaps she had happened, as perhaps Goose had brought tobacco to old man. But it didn't seem so much as though she had happened to him. And after all, he had no scars like walking elks that would remind either his hearers or himself that he spoke truth. In truth, he was growing bored with drinking and stories. The real truth was that he longed to escape to the furs and cool darkness of his bed platform, shed his clothes, and curl his hot nakedness around his wife. Her name meant works with her hands, but in the privacy of bed, he called her Emily. Their time was growing short. In 2 moons more, she would leave to go to the women's house, and he wouldn't see her. Another moon before the child came, 1 more after that for cleansing. The thought of 2 months spent cold and alone without her next to him at night was enough to make him reach for the beer as it came round, and drink deep. Only the bucket was empty. His friends giggled as he held it upside down above his open mouth, a single amber drop splattering on his surprised nose. A small hand reached over his shoulder and took the bucket from his grasp as its partner reached over his other shoulder, holding a full one. He took the bucket and twisted, smiling up at her. Works with her hands smiled smugly back. It gave her great pleasure to anticipate his wants. She knelt behind him, the curve of her belly pressing warm against his back, and swatted away Turtle's hand as he reached for the beer. "No, let my husband have it. He tells much better stories when he's drunk." Turtle closed one eye, fixing her with the other.
He was swaying slightly. "Is it that he tells better stories when he's drunk?" he asked. "Or do we just think they're better because we're drunk?"
Works with her hands ignored this philosophical inquiry and proceeded to make room for herself at the half, swinging her solid little bum deftly back and forth like a battering ram. She settled comfortably next to Ian, folding her arms atop her mound. Other young women had come in with her, bringing more beer. They nudged their way in among the young men, murmuring, poking and laughing. He'd been wrong, Ian thought, watching them. The firelight shone on their faces, glanced from their teeth, caught the moist shine of eyes and the soft dark flesh inside their mouths as they laughed. The fire gleamed on their faces more than it had ever shone from the crystal and silver of Rose Hall.
"So, husband," Emily said, lowering her eyelids demurely, "tell us about this woman with green eyes."
He took a thoughtful swallow of beer, then another.
"Oh," he said, "she was a witch and a very wicked woman. But she did make good beer."
Emily's eyes flew open wide and everyone laughed. He looked into her eyes and saw it clearly, the image of the fire behind him, tiny and perfect, welcoming him in.
"But not as good as yours," he said.
He lifted the bucket in salute and drank deep. Chapter 70 Emily. Brianna woke in the morning, stiff and sore, but with one clear thought in mind.
"Okay, I know who I am."
She had no clear idea where she was, but that didn't matter. She lay still for a moment, feeling oddly peaceful, despite the urge to get up and pee. How long had it been, she wondered, since she had wakened alone and peaceful, with no company but her own thoughts? Really, not since she had stepped through the stones, she thought, in search of her family, and found them.
"In spades," she murmured, stretching gingerly.
She groaned, staggered to her feet, and shuffled into the brush to pee and change back into her own clothes before returning to the blackened fire ring. She unplaited her draggled hair and began groggily combing her fingers through it. There was no sign of Ian or the dog nearby, but she wasn't concerned. The wood around her was filled with the racket of birds, but not alarm calls, just the daily business of flutter and feeding. A cheerful chatter that didn't alter when she rose. The birds had been watching her for hours. They weren't concerned either. She never woke easily, but the simple pleasure of not being dragged from sleep by the insistent demands of those who did made the morning air seem particularly sweet, in spite of the bitter tang of ashes from the dead fire. Mostly awake, she wiped a handful of dew-wet poplar leaves over her face by way of a morning toilet, then squatted by the fire ring and began the chore of fire-starting. They had no coffee to boil, but Ian would be hunting. With luck, there'd be something to cook. They'd eaten everything in the knapsack save a heel of bread. "Heck with this," she muttered, whacking flint and steel together for the dozenth time, and seeing the spatter of sparks wink out without catching. If Ian had only told her they were camping, she would have brought her fire striker or some matches. Though on second thought, she wasn't sure that would be safe. The things could easily burst into flames in her pocket.
"How did the Greeks do it?"
she said aloud, scowling at the tiny mat of charred cloth on which she was attempting to catch a spark. "They must have had a way."
"The Greeks had what?"
Ian and Rollo were back, having captured, respectively, half a dozen yams and a blue-grey waterbird of some kind, a small heron. Rollo refused to allow her to look at it and took his prey off to devour under a bush, its long, limp yellow legs dragging on the ground.
"The Greeks had what?"
Ian repeated, turning out a pocket full of chestnuts, red-brown skins gleaming from the remnants of their prickly hulls.
"Had stuff called phosphorus. You ever heard of it?"
Ian looked blank and shook his head.
"No. What is it?"
"Stuff," she said, finding no better word to hand.
Lord John sent me some so I could make matches.
Matches between whom?
Ian inquired, regarding her warily. She stared at him for a moment, her morning-sodden mind making slow sense of the conversation.
Oh, she said, having at last discovered the difficulty. Not that kind of match, those fire starters I made. Phosphorus burns by itself. I'll show you when we get home.
She yawned and gestured vaguely at the small pile of unlit kindling in the fire ring. Ian made a tolerant Scottish noise and took up the flint and steel himself.
I'll do it. Do the nuts, eh?
Okay. Here, you should put your shirt back on. Her own clothes had dried, and while she missed the comfort of Ian's buckskin, the warm, thick wool of her fringed hunting shirt was warm and soft on her skin. It was a bright day, but chilly so early in the morning. Ian had discarded his blanket while starting the fire, and his bare shoulders were pebbled with goose flesh. He shook his head slightly, though, indicating that he'd put on his shirt in a bit. For now, his tongue stuck out the corner of his mouth in concentration as he struck flint and steel again, then disappeared as he muttered something under his breath.
What did you say?
She paused, a half-hulled nut in her fingers.
Oh, it's no better.
He struck once more and caught a spark, glowing like a tiny star on the square of char. Hastily, he touched a wisp of dry grass to it, then another, and as a tendril of smoke rose up, added a bark chip, more grass, a handful of chips, and finally, a careful criss-cross of pine twigs.
No but a fire charm, he finished, grinning at her over the infant blaze that had sprung up before him.
She applauded briefly, then proceeded to cut the skin of the chestnut she was holding, crosswise, so it wouldn't burst in the fire.
"I haven't heard that one," she said. "Tell me the words."
"Oh." He didn't blush easily, but the skin of his throat darkened a little.
It's no the Gaelic, that one. It's the Ganyangahaga."
Her brows went up, as much as the easy sound of the word on his tongue as at what he'd said.
"Do you ever think in Mohawk, Ian?" she asked curiously.
He shot her a glance of surprise, almost, she thought, of fright.
"No," he said tersely, and rose off his heels. "I'll fetch a bit of wood."
"I have some," she said, holding him with a stare. She reached behind her, and thrust a fallen pine bough into the kindling fire. The dry needles burst in a puff of sparks and were gone, but the ragged bark began to catch and burn at the edges.
"What is it?" she said. "What I said about thinking in Mohawk?"
His lips pressed tight together, not wanting to answer.
"You asked me to come," she said, not sharp with him, but firm.
"So I did." He took a deep breath, then looked down at the yams he was burying in the heating ashes to bake. She worked on the nuts slowly, watching him make up his mind. Loud chewing sounds and intermittent puffs of blue-grey feathers drifted out from under Rollo's bush behind him.
"Did you dream last night, Brianna?" he asked suddenly, his eyes still on what he was doing.
She wished he had brought something coffee-like to boil, but still, she was sufficiently awake by now as to be able to think and respond coherently.
"Yes," she said, "I dream a lot."
"Aye, I ken that. Roger Mack told me you write them down sometimes."
"He did?"
That was a jolt, and one bigger than a cup of coffee. She'd never hidden her dream book from Roger, but they didn't really discuss it either. How much of it had he read?
"He didn't tell me anything about them," Ian assured her, catching the tone of her voice. "Only that you wrote things down sometimes. So I thought, maybe, those would be important."
"Only to me," she said, but cautiously.
"Why?"
"Well, do you see, Laganyan Cahaga set great store by dreams, more even than Highlanders.
He glanced up with a brief smile, then back at the ashes where he had buried the yams.
What did you dream of last night, then?
Birds, she said, trying to recall. Lots of birds.
Reasonable enough, she thought. The forest around her had been live with birdsong since well before dawn. Of course it would seep into her dreams.
Aye. Ian seemed interested.
Were the birds alive, then?
Yes, she said, puzzled. Why?
He nodded and picked up a chestnut to help her. That's good, to dream of live birds, especially if they sing. Dead birds are a bad thing in a dream.
They were definitely alive and singing, she assured him, with a glance up at the branch above him, where some bird with a bright yellow breast and black wings had lighted, viewing their breakfast preparations with interest.
Did any of them talk to you?
She stared at him, but he was clearly serious.
And after all, she thought, why wouldn't a bird talk to you in a dream?
She shook her head, though. No, they were...
Oh!
She laughed, unexpectedly recalling. They were building a nest out of toilet paper.
I dream about toilet paper all the time. That's a thin, soft kind of paper that you use to wipe your behind with, she explained, seeing his incomprehension.
You wipe your ass with paper?
He stared at her, jaw dropped in horror.
Jesus God, Brianna!
Well, she rubbed a hand under her nose, trying not to laugh at his expression. He might well be horrified. There were no paper mills in the colonies, and aside from tiny amounts of handmade paper, such as she made herself, every sheet had to be imported from England. Paper was hoarded and treasured. Her father, who wrote frequently to his sister in Scotland, would write a letter in the normal fashion, but then would turn the paper sideways and write additional lines perpendicularly to save space. Little wonder that Ian was shocked.
It's very cheap, then, she assured him. Really?
Not as cheap as a cob of maize, I'll warrant, he said, narrow-eyed with suspicion.
Believe it or not, most people then won't have cornfields to hand, she said, still amused.
And I tell you what, Ian, toilet paper is much nicer than a dry corn cob.
Nicer, he muttered, obviously still shaken to the core. Nicer? Jesus, Mary and Bride.
You were asking me about dreams, she reminded him. Did you dream last night?
No.
He turned his attention from the scandalous notion of toilet paper with some difficulty.
Or at least if I did, I didn't recall it.
It came to her suddenly, looking at his hollowed face, that one reason for his sleeplessness might be that he was afraid of what dreams might come to him. In fact, he seemed afraid now that she might press him on the subject. Not meeting her eye, he picked up the empty beer jug and clicked his tongue for Rollo, who followed him, blue-grey feathers sticking to his jaws. She had cut the last of the chestnut skins and buried the gleaming marrons in the ashes to bake with the yams by the time he came back.
Just in time, she called, seeing him. The yams are ready.
Just in time, Forby, he answered, smiling. See what I've got.
What he had was a chunk of honeycomb, thieved from a bee tree, and still chilled enough that the honey ran slow and thick, drizzled over the hot yams in glorious blobs of gold sweetness. Garnished with peeled sweet chestnuts and washed down with cold creek water, she thought it was possibly the best breakfast she'd eaten since leaving her own time. She said as much, and Ian lifted one feathery brow in derision.
Oh, aye. And what would you eat, then, that's better?
Oh, chocolate doughnuts, maybe? Or hot chocolate with marshmallows in it? I really miss chocolate. Though it was hard to miss it much at the moment, licking honey off her fingers. Oh, kill me, you. I've had chocolate. He squinched his eyes and pinched his lips in exaggerated distaste. Bitter nasty stuff. Though they did charge a terrible lot of money just for a wee cup of it in Edinburgh, he added practically, unsquinching. She laughed. They put sugar in it where I come from, she assured him. It's sweet.
Sugar in your chocolate? That's the most decadent thing I've ever heard of, he said severely. Even worse than the ass-wiping paper, aye?
She saw the teasing glint in his eye, though, and merely snorted, nibbling the last shreds of orange yam flesh from the blackened skin. Some day I'll get hold of some chocolate, Ian, she said, discarding the limp peel and licking her fingers like a cat. I'll put sugar in it and feed it to you, and see what you think then. It was his turn to snort good-naturedly, but he made no further remarks, concentrating instead on licking his own hands clean. Rollo had appropriated the remnants of honeycomb and was noisily gnawing and slurping at the wax with complete enjoyment. That dog must have the digestion of a crocodile, Brianna said, shaking her head. Is there anything he won't eat?
Well, I've no tried him on nails yet.
Ian smiled briefly, but didn't take up the conversation. The unease that had lain upon him when he'd talked of dreams had disappeared over breakfast, but seemed now to have returned. The sun was well up, but he made no move to rise. He merely sat, arms wrapped about his knees, gazing thoughtfully into the fire as the rising sun stole the light from the flames. In no great hurry to start moving herself, Brianna waited patiently, eyes fixed on him. "And what would you eat for breakfast when you live with a Mohawk, Ian?" He looked at her then, and his mouth tucked in at one corner. Not a smile, but a wry acknowledgement. He sighed and laid his head on his knees, face hidden. He sat slumped that way for a bit, then slowly straightened up. "Well," he said, in a matter-of-fact tone of voice, "it was to do with my brother-in-law, at least to start." Ian Murray thought that before too long he would be obliged to do something about his brother-in-law. Not that brother-in-law was precisely the word for it. Still, Son Elk was the husband of Looking at the Sky, who was in turn the sister of his own wife. By the notions of the Ganyangahaga, this implied no relation between the men beyond that of clansmen, but Ian still thought of Sun Elk with the white part of his mind. That was the secret part. His wife had English, but they didn't speak it, even when most private. He spoke no word of Scots or English aloud, had heard not a syllable of either tongue in the year since he had chosen to stay, to become Ganyangahaga. It was assumed he had forgotten what he had been. But each day he found some moment to himself, and, lest he lose the words, would silently name the objects around him, hearing their English names echo in the hidden white part of his mind. Pot, he thought to himself, squinting at the blackened earthenware warming in the ashes. In fact, he wasn't alone at the moment. He was, however, feeling distinctly alien. Corn, he thought, leaning back against the polished tree trunk that formed one upright of the longhouse. Several clusters of dried maize hung above him, festively coloured by comparison with the sacks of grain sold in Edinburgh, and yet corn, nonetheless. Onions, he thought, eyes passing down the braided chain of yellow globes. Bed, furs, fire. His wife leaned toward him, smiling, and the words ran suddenly together in his mind. Black raven, black hair shining, breast buds, thighs so round, oh yes, oh yes, oh yes, oh Emily. She set a warm bowl in his hand, and the rich aroma of rabbit and corn and onion rose up into his nose. Stew, he thought, the slippery flow of words coming to a sudden halt as his mind focused on food.
He smiled at her and laid his hand over hers, holding it for a moment, small and sturdy under his, curved around the wooden bowl. Her smile deepened, and then she pulled away, rising up to go and fetch more food. He watched her go, appreciating the sway of her walk. Then his eye caught Sun Elk, watching too, from the doorway of his own apartment. Bastard, Ian thought, very clearly.
See, we got on well enough to start, Ian explained. He's a bonny man, for the most part, Sun Elk.
For the most part, Brianna echoed. She sat still, watching him. And which part was that? Ian rubbed a hand through his hair, making it stand up like the bushy quills on a porcupine.
Well, the friend part. We were friends to begin with, aye? Brothers, in fact. We were of the same clan.
And you stopped being friends because of your wife? Ian sighed deeply.
Well, you see, the Ganyangahaga, they've a notion of marriage that... It's like what you see in the Highlands often enough. That is, the parents have a good deal to do with arranging it. Often enough, they've watched the wains as they grew, and seen if maybe there was a lad and a lassie that seemed well matched. And if they were, and if they came from the proper clans. Now, that's a bit different, see? He added, breaking off. The clans? Aye. In the Highlands, you'd mostly marry within your own clan, save it was to make an alliance with another. Among the Iroquois nations, though, you cannot ever marry someone from your own clan. And you can only marry someone from particular clans, not just any other.
Mama said the Iroquois reminded her a lot of Highlanders, Brianna said, mildly amused. Ruthless but entertaining, was how she put it, I think.
Bar some of the torturing, maybe, and the burning your enemies alive.
Your mother's no-heard some of Uncle Jamie's stories about his grandsire, then, he replied with a wry smile.
What? Lord Lovett?
No, the other. Seamus Ruey. Red Jacob. Him Uncle Jamie's named for. A wicked old bugger, my mam always said. He'd put any Iroquois to shame for pure cruelty, from all I've heard of him. He dismissed this tangent with a wave of the hand, though, returning to his explanation.
Well, so, when the Ganyangahaga took me and named me, I was adopted to the Wolf Clan, aye? He said, with an explanatory nod at Rollo, who had consumed the honeycomb, dead bees and all, and was now meditatively licking his paws.
Very appropriate, she murmured. What clan was Sun Elk?
Wolf, of course, and Emily's mother and grandmother and sisters were Turtle. But what was I saying? If a lad and a lassie from properly different clans seemed maybe suited to each other, then the mothers would speak. They call all the aunties mother, too, he added, so there might be a good many mothers involved in the matter. But if all the mothers and grandmothers and aunties were to agree that it would be a good match, he shrugged, they'd marry.
Brianna rocked back a little, arms around her knees.
But you didn't have a mother to speak for you. Well, I did wonder what my mam would have said if she'd been there, he said, and smiled despite his seriousness.
Brianna, having met Ian's mother, laughed at the thought.
Aunt Jenny would be a match for any Mohawk, male or female, she assured him.
But what happened then?
I loved Emily, he said very simply. And she loved me.
This state of affairs, which rapidly became apparent to everyone in the village, caused considerable public comment. Weko Takisan on Hassa, works with her hands, the girl Ian called Emily, had been widely expected to marry Sun Elk, who had been a visitor to her family's hearth since childhood.
But there it was.
Ian spread his hands and shrugged.
She loved me, and she said so.
When Ian had been taken into the Wolf Clan, he had been given to foster parents as well, the parents of the dead man in whose stead he had been adopted. His foster mother had been somewhat taken aback by the situation, but after discussing the matter with the other women of the Wolf Clan, had gone to speak formally with Dawaktanyon, Emily's grandmother, and the most influential woman in the village.
And so we married.
Dressed in their best and accompanied by their parents, the two young people had sat together on a bench before the assembled people of the village and exchanged baskets, his containing the furs of sable and beaver, and a good knife, symbolizing his willingness to hunt for her and protect her, hers filled with grain and fruit and vegetables, symbolizing her willingness to plant, gather, and provide for him.
And 4 moons later, Ian added, Sun Elk wed, looking at the sky, Emily's sister.
Brianna raised one eyebrow. But...
Aye. But...
Ian had the gun Jamie had left with him, a rare and valued item among the Indians, and he knew how to use it. He also knew how to track, to lie in ambush, to think like an animal. Other things of value that Uncle Jamie had left with him. In consequence, he was a good hunter, and rapidly gained respect for his ability to bring in meat. Sun Elk was a decent hunter, not the best, but capable. Many of the young men would joke and make remarks, denigrating each other's skills and making fun. He did it himself. Still, there was a tone to Sun Elk's jests to Ian that now and then made one of the other men glance sharply at him, then away with the faintest of shrugs. He had been inclined to ignore the man. Then he had seen Sun Elk look at works with her hands, and everything became at once clear to him. She had been going to the forest with some other girls one day in late summer. They carried baskets for gathering. Works with her hands had an axe through her belt. One of the other girls had asked her whether she meant to find wood for another bull like the one she had made for her mother. Works with her hands had said, with a quick, warm look toward Ian, who lounged nearby with the other young men, that, no, she wished to find a good red cedar for wood to make a cradle board. The girls had giggled and embraced Works with her hands. The young men had grinned and prodded Ian knowingly in the ribs. And Ian had caught a glimpse of Sun Elk's face, hot eyes fixed on Emily's straight back as she walked away. Within 1 moon, Sun Elk had moved into the longhouse, husband to his wife's sister, looking at the sky. The sisters' compartments were across from each other. They shared a half. Ian had seldom seen Sun Elk look at Emily again, but he had seen him look carefully away too many times.
"There is a person who desires you," he said to Emily one night.
It was long past the hour of the wolf, deep night, and the longhouse slept around them. The child she carried obliged her to rise and make water. She had come back to their furs, skin-chilled, and with the fresh smell of pines in her hair.
"Oh, well, why not? Everyone else is asleep."
She had stretched luxuriously and kissed him, the small bulge of her belly smooth and hard against his.
"Not me. I mean, of course this person desires you too," he'd said hastily, as she drew back a bit, offended.
He wrapped his arms about her in quick illustration.
"I mean, there's someone else."
"Hmm." Her voice was muffled, her breath warm against his chest.
"There are many who desire me. I'm very, very good with my hands."
She gave him a brief demonstration, and he gasped, causing her to chuckle with satisfaction. Rollo, who had accompanied her outside, crawled under the bed platform and curled up in his accustomed spot, chewing noisily at an itching spot near his tail. A little later, they lay with the furs thrown back. The hide that hung over their doorway was pulled back, so the heat of the fire could come in and he could see the shine of light on the moist gold skin of her shoulder, where she lay turned away from him. She reached back and put one of her clever hands on his, took his palm, and pressed it against her belly. The child inside had begun to stir. He felt a soft, sudden push against his palm, and his breath stilled in his throat.
"You shouldn't worry," Emily said, very softly. "This person desires only you."
He had slept well. In the morning, though, he had sat by the hearth eating cornmeal mush, and Sun Elk, who had already eaten, walked by. He stopped and looked down at Ian.
"This person dreamed about you, Wolf's brother."
"Did you?" Ian said pleasantly. He felt the warmth rise up his throat, but kept his face relaxed. The Ganyan Gahaga set great store by dreams. A good dream would have everyone in the longhouse discussing it for days. The look on Sun Elk's face didn't indicate that his dream about Ian had been a good one.
"That dog,"
he nodded at Rollo, who lay sprawled inconveniently in the doorway of Ian's compartment, snoring.
"I dreamed that it rose up over your couch and seized you by the throat."
That was a menacing dream. A Ganyan Gahaga who believed such a dream might decide to kill the dog, lest it be a foretelling of ill fortune. But Ian was not quite Ganyan Gahaga. Ian raised both brows and went on eating. Sun Elk waited for a moment, but as Ian said nothing, eventually nodded and turned away.
"Sun Elk,"
Ian said, calling his name. The man turned back, expectant.
"This person dreamed of you,
too."
Sun Elk glanced sharply at him.
Ian didn't speak further, but let a slow and evil smile grow upon his face. Sun Elk stared at him. He kept smiling. The other man turned away with a snort of disgust, but not before Ian had seen the faint look of unease in Sun Elk's eyes.
"Well, so,"
Ian took a deep breath. He closed his eyes briefly, then opened them.
"You ken the child died, aye?"
He spoke with no emotion at all in his voice. It was that dry, controlled tone that seared her heart and choked her so that she could do no more than nod in reply. He couldn't keep it up, though. He opened his mouth as though to speak, but the big bony hands clenched suddenly on his knees, and instead he rose abruptly to his feet.
"Aye," he said. "Let's go. I'll tell you the rest, walking."
And he did, his back resolutely turned as he led her higher up the mountain, then across a narrow ridge and down the path of a stream that fell in a series of small, enchanting waterfalls, each encircled with a mist of miniature rainbows. Works with her hands had conceived again. That child was lost just after her belly began to swell with life.
"They say the Ganyan Gahaga," Ian explained, his voice muffled as he shoved his way through a screen of brilliant red creeper, "that for a woman to conceive, her husband's spirit does battle with hers and must overcome it. If a spirit isna strong enough..."
His voice came clear as he ripped a handful of creeper down, breaking the branch it hung from, and cast it viciously away.
"Then the child canna take root in the womb."
After this second loss, the Medicine Society had taken the two of them to a private hut, there to sing and beat drums, and to dance in huge painted masks meant to frighten away whatever evil entities might be hampering Ian's spirit, or unduly strengthening Emily's.
"I wanted to laugh, seeing the masks," Ian said.
He didn't turn round. Yellow leaves spangled the shoulders of his buckskin and stuck in his hair.
"They call it the Funny Face Society, too. And for a reason. Didna do it, though."
"I don't suppose, Emily laughed. He was going so fast that she was pressed to keep up with him, though her legs were nearly as long as his own.
No, he said, and uttered a short, bitter laugh himself. She didna. She'd gone into the medicine hut beside him, silent and grey, but had come out with a peaceful face and reached for him in their bed that night with love. For 3 months they had made love with tenderness and ardour. For another 3 they had made love with a sense of increasing desperation. And then she missed her courses again. He had at once seized his attentions, terrified of causing a further mishap. Emily had moved slowly and carefully, no longer going into the fields to work, but staying in the longhouse, working, always working with her hands, weaving, grinding, carving, boring beads of shell for wampum, hands moving ceaselessly to compensate for the waiting stillness of her body. Her sister went to the fields. It's the women who do it, Ken. He paused to slash an outreaching briar with his knife, tossing the severed branch out of the way so that it wouldn't snap back and hit Brianna in the face. Looking at the sky brought us food. All the women did, but her most of all. She was a sweet lass, looking at the sky. There was a slight catch in his voice at this, the first in his harsh recitation of facts. What happened to her? Brianna hastened her step a little as they came out onto the top of a grass-covered bank, so that she drew up nearly even with him. He slowed a little, but didn't turn to look at her, kept his face forward, chin raised as though confronting enemies. Taken. Looking at the sky had been in the habit of staying later in the fields than the other women, gathering extra corn or squash for her sister and Ian, though she had a child of her own by then. One evening she didn't return to the longhouse, and when the villagers had gone out to search for her, neither she nor the child was anywhere to be found. They had vanished, leaving only one pale moccasin behind, tangled in the squash vines at the edge of a field. "Abenaki," Ian said tersely. "We found the sign next day. It was full dark before we began to search in earnest." It had been a long night searching, followed by a week of the same, a week of growing fear and emptiness, and Ian had returned to his wife's hearth at dawn on the 7th day to learn that she had miscarried once more. He paused. He was sweating freely from walking so fast and wiped a sleeve across his chin. Brianna could feel the sweat trickling down her own back, dampening the hunting shirt, but disregarded it. She touched his back very gently, but said nothing. He heaved a deep sigh, almost of relief, she thought. Perhaps that the dreadful tale was nearly done. "We tried a bit longer," he said, back to the matter-of-fact tone, "Emily and I. But the heart had gone out of her. She didn't trust me any more. And Sunilk was there. He ate at her hearth, and he watched her. She began to look back." Ian had been shaping wood for a bow one day, concentrating on the flow of the grain beneath his knife, trying to see those things in the swirls that Emily saw, to hear the voice of the tree, as she had told him. It wasn't the tree that spoke behind him, though. "Grandson," said a dry old voice, lightly ironic. He dropped the knife, narrowly missing his own foot, and swung round, bow in hand. Dawok Tanyun stood 6 feet away, one eyebrow lifted in amusement at having sneaked up on him unheard. "Grandmother," he said, and nodded in wry acknowledgement of her skill. Ancient she might be, but no one moved more softly. Hence her reputation. The children of the village lived in respectful dread of her, having heard that she could vanish into air, only to rematerialize in some distant spot, right before the guilty eyes of evildoers. "Come with me, Wolf's brother," she had said, and turned away, not waiting for his response. None was expected.
She was already out of sight by the time he had laid the half-made bow under a bush, taken up his fallen knife, and whistled for Rollo. But he caught her up with no difficulty. She had led him away from the village, through the forest, to the head of a deer trail. There she had given him a bag of salt and an armlet of wampum, and bade him go.
"And you went?" Brianna asked, after a long moment of silence.
"Just like that?"
"Just like that," he said,
and looked at her for the first time since they had left their campsite that morning. His face was gaunt, hollow with memories. Sweat gleamed on his cheekbones, but he was so pale that the dotted lines of his tattoos stood out sharp, perforations, lines along which his face might come apart. She swallowed a few times before she could speak, but managed a tone much like his own when she did.
"Is it much farther?" she asked. "Where we're going?"
"No," he said softly. "We're nearly there,"
and turned to walk again before her. Half an hour later, they had reached a place where the stream cut deep between its banks, widening into a small gorge. Silver birch and hobble bush grew thick, sprouting from the rocky walls, smooth-skinned roots twisting through the stones like fingers clawing at the earth. The notion gave Brianna a slight prickle at the neck. The waterfalls were far above them now, and the noise of the water had lessened, the creek talking to itself as it purled over rocks and shushed through mats of cress and duckweed. She thought the going might be easier above, on the lip of the gorge, but Ian led her down into it without hesitation, and she followed likewise, scrambling over the tumble of boulders and tree roots, hampered by her long gun. Rollo, scorning this clumsy exertion, plunged into the creek, which was several feet deep, and swam, ears clamped back against his head, so that he looked like a gigantic otter. Ian had recovered his self-possession in the concentration of navigating the rough ground. He paused now and then, reaching back to help her down a particularly tricky fall of rock, or over a tree uprooted in some recent flood, but he didn't meet her eyes, and the shuttered planes of his face gave nothing away. Her curiosity had reached fever pitch, but clearly he had finished speaking for the moment. It was just past midday, but the light under the birches was a shadowed gold that made everything seem somehow hushed, almost enchanted. She could make no sensible guess as to the purpose of this expedition in light of what Ian had told her, but the place was one where almost anything seemed possible. She thought suddenly of her first father, of Frank Randall, and felt a small remembered warmth at the thought. She would like so much to show him this place. They had taken holidays often in the Adirondacks, different mountains, different trees, but something of the same hush and mystery in the shadowed glades and rushing water. Her mother had come sometimes, but more often it was just the two of them, hiking far up into the trees, not talking much, but sharing a deep content in the company of the sky. Suddenly, the sound of the water rose again. There was another fall nearby.
"Just here, cuz," Ian said softly,
and beckoned her to follow with a turn of the head. They stepped out from under the trees, and she saw that the gorge dropped suddenly away, the water falling 20 feet or more into a pool below. Ian led her past the head of the falls. She could hear the water rushing past below, but the top of the bank was thick with sedges, and they had to push their way through, tramping down the yellowing stems of goldenrod and dodging the panicked whir of grasshoppers rocketing up underfoot.
"Look," Ian said, glancing back,
and reached to part the screen of laurel in front of her.
"Wow!"
She recognized it immediately. There was no mistaking it, in spite of the fact that much of it was invisible, still buried in the crumbling bank on the far side of the gorge. Some recent flood had raised the level of the creek, undercutting the bank, so that a huge block of stone and dirt had fallen away, revealing its buried mystery. The raked arches of ribs rose huge from the dirt, and she had the impression of a scatter of things half buried in the rubble at the foot of the bank. Enormous things, knobbed,
and twisted. They might be bones or simply boulders, but it was the tusk that caught her eye, jutting from the bank in a massive curve, intensely familiar, and the more startling for its very familiarity.
"You ken it?" Ian asked eagerly, watching her face. "You've seen something like it?"
"Oh, yes," she said. And though the sun was warm on her back, she shivered, goose-flesh pebbling her forearms. Not from fear, but sheer awe at sight of it, and a kind of incredulous joy. "Oh, yes, I have."
"What?" Ian's voice was still pitched low, as though the creature might hear them. "What is it?"
"A mammoth," she said, and found that she was whispering too. The sun had passed its zenith. Already the bottom of the creek bed lay in shadow. Light struck the stained curve of ancient ivory, and threw the vault of the high-crowned skull that held it into sharp relief. The skull was fixed in the soil at a slight angle.